Welcome to Gin and Tubbeck.
Woo!
We are here for another series.
Yep, another one. Just keeps happening. Just keeps going.
It does. And so we got loads of gins.
Oh yeah, tons of gin.
Tons of gin.
Tons of experts.
Yeah.
Tons of topics.
Well, and that's the thing, you see. Give us a gin.
Talk to anyone.
We will. Mm. We will talk to anyone about anything. So yeah, we're going to talk to a ton of people about loads of stuff over gin.
And I'm going to make rude comments while we do it to stay on brand.
And you never know, we might actually learn some stuff. We might even remember stuff.
Oh, that's not going to happen anytime soon. Who are we talking to?
So we're talking to Dr. Andrew Farah, and he is a science communicator and head of programs and delivery at Cambridge Science Centre.
Okay.
But the stuff that we're talking about was when he was doing his PhD, which wasn't at Cambridge. It was in the University of Adelaide in South Australia.
Oh, how lovely.
But yeah, so he did his PhD in South Australia, and even though he's not working on a PhD or researching, because he does lots of stuff with the Science Centre, he's still involved in the work that he did. He's still like the expert in that area.
Good for him.
So, yeah, that's quite cool.
That's nice.
He's still doing that.
Excellent.
But he doesn't drink alcohol.
Oh, okay. That's quite nice. There's a lot of people choosing not to drink alcohol at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, bit of a moment.
We're still going to drink gin.
Because there are lots of non-alcoholic gins available out there. Woo!
And it's a non-alcoholic gin from a gin distillery.
Ooh.
Ah.
Okay.
So that's going to be quite exciting.
Nil. Oh, I get it. Like no alcohol.
Like no alcohol.
Right. Sounds good.
New London Light.
Yeah.
And it's won awards. And it's made, I think, using the same principles as gin. So I'm really excited about it.
And we've got an interesting pairing for this one.
We have. And the pairing was what they suggested. And the pairing is orange and sage leaf. So go on, pour it. Because I didn't think I'd be excited about a non-alcoholic gin, but I am really excited.
And you know what? Sometimes I don't want the alcohol, but yeah. I do want the taste.
And we're pairing it with just refreshingly light Fever Tree.
Light, but with orange and sage, which I've never had in a gin before.
No, I normally just pick the sage at Christmas to go in the stuffing.
I like it when Dad puts it with butter and coats
With pasta.
Yeah.
Well, we have lots of sage in the garden. And so this is freshly picked. Freshly picked sage. Right.
What's orange.
Does it smell like gin?
Don't you?
Cheers.
That's nice. That's refreshing.
That is refreshing.
And you know what? It's very refreshing. You know what? I would love to put it in a tall glass with some mint.
Oh.
Some cucumber.
It's really citrusy.
It's delicious.
It is really lovely. And I do like the sage and the orange in it.
I do. Sometimes I want to try it in other gins.
You know when you add orange sometimes to a gin and it becomes really like...
too much. Yeah.
Cloyy.
Yeah.
Too orangey. But this actually just adds a little bit of orangey.
I want sage in more drinks.
And sage. Lovely. Yum, yum.
Right. What a turn up for the books.
Indeed. So, Andrew's here. Let's have a chat. I haven't told you what the
topic
or the question is. So, are you ready?
Yeah.
Our topic.
Yeah.
Dentist for the dead.
Oh, God. Horrible histories.
It does, doesn't it? Make you think of horrible
stupid
histories.
Stupid deaths, they're funny because they're true. Stupid deaths. Hope next time is not you. Oh-ho.
Dentist for the dead. Can we learn about a person's life by looking at bacteria?
Oh, fuck me. This is going to mess in my head again.
It is.
Oh, good.
So it's going to be horrible histories.
Yeah.
But yeah, how on earth bacteria on dead people's teeth? And
I'm
what we can learn
sure
about their lives.
About this.
Well, let's invite Andrew in. And we can talk about what we already know about dentists for the dead.
You'll be a dentist.
Here he comes.
That was a little Shop of Horrors.
I like that.
The most important, gin.
Gin is here. Do not worry.
Excellent.
So we have poured.
We went ahead.
It's such a satisfying sound, isn't it?
I love that noise.
It's so good. Yeah.
And I've got to say, I'm really excited about this because I've been looking for a non-alcoholic gin. And I think I've found one because this tastes really good.
And we have tried a couple before and they've tasted
interesting.
Pants.
Okay, pants. Yeah.
We won't name them. They tasted pants.
No. But this one's a nice one.
I'm glad I get to start with a nice one and learn from your experience. Cheers.
Well, cheers.
Cheers.
It's just good. Yeah.
It is.
See, it makes your shoulders do the little thing that you do when you have a drink that you're really pleased with.
We put orange and sage in ours, which is really, really nice.
Because Sarah's bougie. Yes,
I see. I feel sort of underdressed in the beverage department now that I'm just drinking it neat, like some kind of nutter.
Oh, love it.
What is it like neat?
It's very nice. It's very nice. It's a milder, because I don't drink, so I've never actually had any type of gin. So it's a bit of a milder taste than I was expecting, but I'm really liking the citrusy side. But then the ginger,
very
and
the
juniper and all that kind of stuff is there as well, like underneath.
Well, now I want to try it neat.
I know, I haven't got anything for you to try it neat.
Well, I'll slurp it straight out of the bottle if I have to. It's not alcoholics, therefore it's not a bad thing to do that. That's how it works,
go with
right?
It. Go with
yeah.
It.
Okay.
Yeah, go on then. Oh. If you can get in there.
Yeah, it's actually quite good.
Is that?
Yeah. That's never something I would do with an alcoholic gin, but it's actually quite good.
Should we just give up with the glasses entirely and just all drink from the bottle?
Just straight from the bottle, maybe get a straw. It's a little bit elderflowery when you have it straight from the bottle.
It is actually more florally. Yeah, more elderflower, a lot more citrusy.
Mm.
But I prefer it with a tonic.
I do, but it's still nice neat, which is quite good.
Yeah. And the great thing is that I can drink many, many glasses of this and not fall over.
Very important.
Not falling over is an excellent result.
Cool. Okay. Thank you very much for allowing us to try a non-alcoholic gin.
I'm very excited.
Thank you for having me on with a non-alcoholic gin.
Of course. So, is this the part where we have to reveal how dumb we are?
Yeah.
Good.
We always do.
Excellent.
Now, you can enjoy your gin.
And while laughing.
We will talk about what we think we might know about your topic and what we think the answers to your question might be or anything else that might come to mind that we think that is particularly relevant. And of course, then you'll decide that none of it is because we are clueless.
Considering I did just sing the Horrible History Stupid Death song.
I did mention the title and that was what came out.
The Horrible Histories, I mean, is great. So if you see the title of this and then you think Horrible History Stupid Death song, then we've won. We can end this now.
Yes!
If
Brilliant! Excellent! My knowledge! Yes!
And it is where most of our knowledge comes from.
Oh,
right,
absolutely.
So we have got the title Dentist for the Dead and Can We Learn About a Person's Life by Looking at Bacteria?
Yes, is my first guess.
Yes, because otherwise we wouldn't be doing a podcast about
it. There would be very little to talk about. How?
Well deduced, Sherlock.
Thank you very much. I am feeling rather intelligent today. Again, could you not guess by the stupid death singing?
How and what do you reckon? I'm just going to ask you these questions and then you can appear stupid and I appear intelligent
that's
by asking questions.
How? Through science. Yep.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
See? What? A plethora of things.
Oh, a plethora.
Thank you.
Nice.
I'm
well
a writer.
Answered. Well answered.
Thank you.
So straight away, I'm thinking bacteria must disappear. So I don't know how the bacteria would still be on. It depends how dead.
Oh, you know, have you thought dead? About how dead? My brain immediately just went to like full skeleton because don't the teeth stay?
Yeah.
They don't rot, right? Because yeah. they're like bone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
So bacteria then stays on teeth.
Well, our mouths are pretty grim, surely. Yeah. Even with brushing, they'd be quite grim.
And if it's really, really dead, then they didn't do much brushing. So there'd be a lot True. More on them
yeah.
than there would on a modern
diet
body.
May yeah. affect it.
Ooh, so then you can tell diet.
I'm throwing it out there.
So then we could tell where they lived. About where their diet is.
Oh, well, you're getting really crazy now. Like I wasn't. Okay, well, you're making some bold statements here. Oh, slow down.
Cool. You could tell how bougie they are by what they're eating. No? As Anya reaches Sips for drink. Her drink. In despair at the use of the word bougie.
No, just at, no, just at you.
Oh, just at me?
Yeah.
Oh.
Sorry.
As usual.
Yeah, I'd never really considered looking at dead people's teeth, funnily enough. It's just not something I've really thought about. I'm sure there must be a detective book out there somewhere where they do it. I watch a lot of Silent Witness. Love me Silent Witness. And they look at, you know, dead people. But they've never looked at the bacteria on people's teeth.
Well, let's look at it then, shall we? Right.
Anything of use in that?
Yeah. No, there was several points in there that you touched on. You mentioned plaque, mm-hmm. and that is the source of the bacteria from these ancient, very dead people.
Well done. And only because Andrew's mentioned plaque before, so I cheated.
What?
Only a little bit. Only because he's mentioned the word, so I thought I'd use it.
Oh, you're so sneaky.
But it is, but if you think that's the thing that we're always told to get rid of on our teeth.
Yeah. How dead are the people we're looking at here? Did they not get told to get rid of the plaque on their teeth?
The people that I worked with were very dead and would not have been removing the plaque off their teeth. What's really interesting, actually, with the amount of plaque on teeth is it changes through time. If we go really ancient, if we go pre-agricultural revolution, so before we had farming, these skeletons, which are tens of thousands of years old, are beautiful teeth because their diet didn't contain very much simple sugar. So if you've ever had like a soft drink and then you really feel that your teeth are getting that kind of plaque buildup, it's because there's loads of simple sugar and the bacteria in our mouths just love the simple sugar. They go wild for it. So they grow and we feel it. And that's why we have to brush to get that off. They didn't have, pre-agriculture, they didn't have these simple sugars in their diet, so they actually didn't get this much buildup. Their teeth were fabulous, really. Then we invented agriculture and it all went a little bit pear-shaped.
Just totally for everything.
It was. I mean, yeah, the human health in general sort of took a bit of quite a significant dip, actually, when we invented agriculture. Very physically demanding work, and the diet wasn't great. They were initially cultivating and domesticating these plants. But yeah, they were getting simpler sugars, and that's when we see the kind of plaque building up and these horrible dental caries, so they didn't have any dentists, they just had holes. It must have been incredibly painful for some of these people, and it just sort of got worse. The Industrial Revolution, when we started really processing these sugars and sort of, things like white bread and tinned foods and all of this, it went horrible, and that's kind of where dentistry really starts to take off. And now we have to be constantly brushing, once, twice a day to kind of keep it all under control. But even then, sometimes it goes.
Yeah. And of course, and when you're saying simple sugars, it's not just sugar, but the simple sugars that are in foods that you wouldn't think are sugary as such. It's not like just sugar cane or sugar beet.
No, exactly. We should we can kind of think of them all as just the carbohydrates, I guess. Sugar is just a carbohydrate.
My favourite food group. Fucking love me the carbs. Love the carbs. They are my favourites.
It's just a pizza and crisps and sort of just toast, is it for you?
Yeah, and a lot of potatoes. Huge amount of potatoes. Yeah, in all various forms. Clearly my teeth will tell a lot about me when I die. Mm. And I'll look at them and be like, oh, she loved her pasta.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. So when you're looking at sort of natural, if you're eating a lot of raw plant material, those carbohydrates are very complex, they're very long structures, and they take a lot of breaking down. And our digestive system actually struggles with it. One of the things bacteria elsewhere in our body do, because we have bacteria everywhere. I focused on the mouth, but we'll probably touch on today, like bacteria on every part of our body.
Okay, so we're riddled with bacteria.
Riddled with them, yes, absolutely covered in them. There's more bacteria on our body than there are our own cells, or at least the same amount. It's absolutely insane. In fact, if you took a spoonful of soil, there would be more bacteria in that spoonful than there would be people on the planet. So we have to remember these things are so incredibly small that we can cram so many of them in.
That's where the science comes in.
And they're not bad. It drives me mad. Constant, let's kill all bacteria. They're not all bad. There are some good guys out there.
There are some very good, very good bacteria. If we took all the bacteria off our body, we would die, which is, how good or how important to us they are. So we definitely need them around. And our body has never existed in an environment that doesn't have bacteria. Bacteria predates the eukaryotes, which is, the cell type that we are. And so anything that you can see pretty much is a eukaryote. And the bacteria from before that. So throughout pretty much our entire evolutionary history, they've always been there. And just like any ecosystem, therefore, there's a playoff against each other. So, we eat food. They use some of that food for themselves. But then some of their, waste products are actually what we can take into our body. And we wouldn't be able to digest that food if it weren't for them. And that's where it starts to get really interesting with the gut microbiome and what's happening inside our digestive system, because it can impact medicines. We all will have an aspirin, but exactly the chemical structure of what reaches our bloodstream is going to be altered depending on what bacteria are having a go at that aspirin between you putting it in your mouth and it actually being absorbed by the body. So they're doing all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah, and so what I know about the gut microbiome as well is that, of course, mine would be different to yours and different to everyone else's. And so getting that right, like with the aspirins, getting the right sort of balance for the responses is what everyone's looking at. And then there's all sorts of connections between that gut health and mental health.
Yakult. That's what I know about gut health. The little yogurty drinks, they're like, it's good for your gut. There you go.
I think that's really good marketing,
though. It's really good marketing because my immediate thought was Yakult.
You'll be very pleased that that's where your mind's gone. And while I have no expertise on the effectiveness of Yakult or anything in a similar vein, we're talking trillions of bacteria, thousands, hundreds of thousands of different species of bacteria. So when these brands say, oh, yeah, we've got our own special bacteria that's really good for your gut, I'm like, okay, so we're adding one and there's thousands of them. I maybe won't do any harm, but is it really addressing the balance? I don't know.
So when you get these really old teeth covered in these thousands, billions, whatever, of bacteria, how do you look at that bacteria?
So we use the DNA of the bacteria.
Ooh.
So I talked about before about the soft drinks and all of these bacteria growing. That's what we can feel on our teeth. If you don't brush your teeth at night, the calcium that's in your saliva will seep into all of that sort of big, squishy mesh of bacteria and then solidify around them. Basically kind of entomb them.
My teeth feel really weird now.
Going to be brushing them pretty soon after this.
I had that a lot when I first started this. I was like, okay, I'm going to, thanks for the meeting. I'm going to go and brush my teeth now. So this plaque will harden into what we call dental calculus, which is exactly as you say, what we find still on the surface of teeth of these people from hundreds, thousands of years ago. And then what we do, what I did, this is where we become our dentist for the dead. We get their skull and do a little bit of cleaning. So we would partner with museums or research institutes who have collections of archaeological remains that they've recovered, and we'd go in with our dental picks and we'd clean the teeth of these people. Far too late for them to appreciate it, but it turned out to be really useful. Really useful for us.
It doesn't sound a very pleasant job to be doing, just scraping stuff off teeth.
I mean, it's not the most exciting thing in the world, if I'm honest. I mean, it's fascinating. There's not many opportunities you get to go into, like, you know, the storage areas of museums and just see all of these amazing collections.
And did they smell?
No.
You know, at that point, they're so dead, aren't they? So
asking the important questions. Well, no, I was going to go like, did you steal something? And you went, did it smell?
Well, I'm thinking that actually maybe being a dentist for the dead would be better than a modern day dentist.
No, they don't smell. And no, I haven't taken anything other than what the museum specifically gave me permission to take. And that is the story I'm sticking to.
Good. Good plan. The less you say now, the less we can say in court. So you go in, you scrape the stuff off the teeth,
yeah,
which requires a hand movement of scraping.
Indeed, exactly like that. And it's spot on.
Thank you. I'm ready for the job. And then you've got all the stuff that... What do you do with the stuff?
What do we do with the stuff? Good question. So this is ancient DNA. Okay, so this is an entire field of research of its own, ancient DNA. And when you're dealing with these ancient samples, be it the stuff we've got off teeth or, you know, potentially if they're working with the teeth or the bones themselves, you've got very little DNA left. Once we're dead and our cells aren't sort of constantly repairing our DNA, it degrades pretty quickly. So there's very little of it left. So I have to take that stuff back to a dedicated ancient DNA lab, which is hyper
sterile. Of which there are 70 locations up and down the country, and you can visit one now.
Not that many, even in the UK.
No.
But there are a few.
Yeah, there's a few. And I actually was doing my work in Australia, the Australian Centre for Ancient DNA. They were the group at the time who were really the first to be doing this with the whole community of bacteria. And that's really what we're after. So we were talking before about like that. How it's this massive ecosystem. So they have a hyper-sterile lab, which is even more important for what we're doing because one of the biggest things to keep out of labs are bacteria. They have a really sterile lab, all divided into sections because they have to do each part of this process in a different section so we don't cross-contaminate things. The first step, very simple, crush it, which generally avoided actually just hitting it with a hammer.
I was thinking pestle and mortar.
No. Some of the fragments were very small, so it could just be a pair of tweezers in a tube. If you got a particularly big bit, you would put it in a bag and you would actually just gently tap it with a hammer just to crush it. And this breaks everything apart, so we expose as many of the bacteria as possible.
It's a bit like crushing biscuits up for a cheesecake when you sort of put them in and just whack it with a rolling pin. I've never really imagined scientists just sort of there with hammers going, let's crush it up a little bit. But now I am.
And so once we've crushed it, what do we do with it?
There's loads of things in there. There's loads of different, we've got bits of protein and fats that are left in there and the DNA and the calcium from the teeth. So we need to get rid of everything but the DNA. So we're actually going to do something we call a digestion to get rid of a whole bunch of that stuff. And that's actually remarkably simple. It's basically washing up liquid salt and water. We give them fancier names in the lab.
I love this. We could be a dentist for the dead in our own kitchen at this rate. We just scrape a bit off, smack it with a hammer.
Sorry, where are you getting access to the skeleton?
Oh, I'd have to kill someone first. Okay.
I was thinking just go and dig up a body and that was bad enough. But you're like, no, let me create the body. I don't feel safe with you.
So we've got... I'll re-listen and write down the ingredients and
washing
the method. But we've got washing up liquid, salt, and what was the other one?
Water.
Excellent. So washing up liquid, salt, and water.
Washing up liquid, salt, and water. Yeah, that's going to. So washing up liquid, just as it does when you're doing the actual washing up, is dissolving the fats, getting rid of stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The salt's there to again help the DNA sort of separate out and get rid of some of the other things that are going on. And that process, when you're doing it the way we were doing it, you would actually leave it for quite some time to just go through that process.
How long is quite some time?
The whole extraction process to go from piece of dental calculus to having just the DNA from that in sterile water, basically, takes 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
It's a bit of time. You've got to prep yourself.
That's a fair waiting period.
It is, yeah. Especially in these labs, because you have to wear, you know, like the forensic suits that you see like the police wearing when they're going in. So you're in one of those. We've got 3 layers of gloves on. You know, there's lots of face masks and visors. It's a whole process to get both in and out of this lab. So when you have to do 2 full days, like back to back, you know, everything's got to be timed right. It can get a bit much.
And that's all because the amount of bacteria that's on you and the fact that you'll contaminate all the results.
Exactly, yeah. Biggest contamination risk in the lab is me.
No pressure.
Yeah, it is terrifying, especially by the end, because you're left with about 1 microliter. That's a thousand of a milliliter of colourless liquid, which you assume has some DNA in if you've done the last 2 days correctly. And then you get to come back and do a whole other day to create a sequencing library where you have to remember which sample the small amount of colourless liquid came from and put the right little markers in that, which is also colourless, and then mix it all together in exactly the right volume.
You couldn't do that at home.
No, where it gets a bit specialist.
I forget which one was which.
Yeah, definitely. And so once you've done all of the specialist stuff, then the fun stuff begins to happen.
So once I've done all of that, I gave it to someone else who knew how to work the DNA sequencing machine, because that was magic as far as I was concerned. and we use what we call next generation sequencing, which is really cool because what it's able to do is sequence. You can give it one sample, but that sample can have loads of different bits of DNA in, and it can tell them all apart and tell you what they are. So we would do that, get all of these sequences, and then we would map it back to just a massive database of every known bacteria that we had to try and identify where these bits of DNA would have come from, and therefore which bacteria were living in the mouth of these people back when they were alive. And that's where you get your community picture from, of what these bacteria were. And that's where we get, eventually, to the bit where we start to go, can we tell anything about their lives from this community we've managed to reconstruct? And the cool thing about the dental calculus work is that, exactly as you were saying earlier, like the bacteria go. When you die, your skin basically decomposes, so the bacteria on it are gone, your gut's gone, everything's gone. So there are some potential ways of getting gut microbiota from fossilized poo.
Which
seems
you were like, now I'll stick to the teeth, thanks. Yeah.
But even a fossilized poo is relatively soft compared to something like, you know. So
and I'm not even going to ask about the smell of that one.
No, I wouldn't recommend. No.
I definitely stayed away from that. So, calculus is sort of considered generally one of the only ways of looking back at the human microbiome, which is a bit of a shame because the microbiomes on the different parts of the body are different and they're doing different things. But at least it's one, and if that's massively changing over time, we can infer that maybe something else is going on as well. And so exactly as we were saying earlier about the agricultural revolution and then the industrial revolution, seeing the health of the teeth just from the amount of caries and things that have fallen out changing, one of the first studies was able to show that the microbiome massively changed as well. So there's a pre-agricultural, agricultural, and a post-industrial microbiome. So
how were they all different? So obviously there was the health issues, but was it also you could look at what they were eating was different just from looking at that?
So this is one of the questions. How much could we tell exactly what they're eating from the community of bacteria that are there? And this was something I was working on when I was doing my PhD and has continued to be worked on. This is the really cool thing about science. I mean, it's not just one person. You know, I got to do all of the stuff and it was awesome. And I, you know, wrote up my thesis and the paper and it was all good. But, you know, I've now left academia, I'm a science communicator, but my supervisor has gone on and they're still analysing the same data and still pulling more and more things out of it and merging it with other stuff. Because what we sort of realised was, okay, we can see which bacteria are there and we can see that some groups maybe have different bacteria from each other, either through time or because of something else that's happening at the same period. But what are those bacteria actually doing? Because you could have two different species of bacteria, for argument's sake, who actually, in terms of their function within the whole community, are basically fulfilling the same role. So again, that's where, so as I said, to find out what the bacteria are, we map all that DNA against a big database of all the bacteria. They also have databases of functional genes these bacteria carry. So if we can map a piece of DNA back to one of those genes, we can say, okay, if that gene was present, which is an instruction for a protein which digests milk, that suggests that bacteria was probably an environment where milk was passing through a reasonable rate. And we were able to show that and show that in these ancient groups, which I was looking at was kind of post-medieval back to sort of ancient, just pre-Roman in England, Britain in general, we saw about a third of the population did have this lactose breaking down gene in there, and then the two-thirds didn't.
And could you infer anything about why some did and some didn't?
So our explanation for it still at the moment is that it's kind of linked to social class.
So you can tell how bougie they were.
I need to re-explain bougie to you.
It's not
the problem.
Drinking.
No.
I'm so sorry for bringing this up. we kind of linked it to social group, and that those in sort of lower social groups were having more of the poorer parts of the plant material. They maybe weren't getting quite as much of the dairy and the cheese and things like that, whereas the sort of upper classes were getting the nice bits, the fruits of the plant rather than the stems, and they were maybe indulging themselves a little bit more in the cheese department.
That reminds me, there's a lot of cheese in our fridge, and I had some for lunch, and I'm probably going to have some for pudding as well. So when I die, feel free to take my teeth and examine the amount of cheese I've been eating. It will be a lot.
Good to know. So that's the sort of start of what we've been able to pull out about people's lives. It's a little bit of what were they eating based on not finding the remains of their food, but what the bacteria in their mouths would have also been eating. Because it would have been the same stuff available to them.
And so what else did you find then? Were there other things like milk? What were there surprising things that you found from that, as you said, haven't been able to find from other things that you've been able to find through teeth?
It's nothing super surprising, but what was really exciting about this was it was so specific to the individual. So it's still a relatively new area of research. That breakdown of social structure was still quite broad, and other types of research, sort of archaeological and looking at actual remains of buildings and the whole site, isotope kind of data, which is often used for understanding diet, is still able to sort of pull things out of finer detail than this is. But this is non-destructive to the actual human remains. It was starting to show these patterns, and then it's just going back and adding more samples and more resolution, as we call it, to try and pull it out even finer.
The more teeth we clean, the more we can learn.
Exactly. It's like some kind of global mission.
Everybody get on it and find some teeth.
Well, now we know how as well. We could do it in our own kitchen as long as it's
no, you can you only do the first two parts. You haven't got the thing to do the last bit.
True.
Yeah, see?
That's true. With too much contamination.
Definitely. With the dogs around, could you imagine? That would really mess up results.
There are so many things that mess up results. There's entire papers, academic papers published on, where things have gone wrong. And it's so disheartening sometimes. I can imagine being the researchers, and it's so hard. If you're looking at human DNA, if you're breaking up a bit of bone, you know that you're looking for human DNA. If you get bacteria in there, that's not a problem. But if you get two humans, you can test against yourself to see whether you've contaminated with bacteria. Who knows what's been on those skeletons, from when that person died and they were buried and they've been collected by a museum, and they've maybe been cleaned, they've been in a box somewhere and they've been transported, So figuring out contamination patterns in this kind of data is really difficult, which is why the practical kind of hyper-sterile is done all the way through. And you do a lot of what are called blanks when you're doing the actual lab work, where you have a tube which you treat exactly the same, you put all the same chemicals in, you do the whole process. You just never actually put any of the dental calculus in. Mm. And then you go, well, yeah, the bacteria in that, then we can assume that, you know, something's got in.
Yeah.
So it's really, really difficult. It's one of the big problems, really, and we've got to be careful, I think, in this field, not to get carried away with a pattern before you've definitely definitely figured out it's real.
There's a lot of telling yourself, just wait, just check.
Yeah. And so you can imagine. And I mean, it's great when you plug it into the computer and you run a certain analysis and you get a nice graph and you can see two groups or three groups. Yes. And then there's exactly that. Okay, hang on. Let's just go back through all the notes when I did this. Please tell me these groups don't align to something I've done.
And then when they don't, you can get excited. That's the moment of yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Until someone smarter walks into the room and goes, well, could it be this? And you're like,
oh. Couldn't you have just kept quiet?
Yes. Get out of my room.
Now, can I ask, who came up with the idea of just like, I know what, we'll scrape some dead bones' teeth and then we'll have a look for DNA? What?
Who thought of that?
What? Where? Why? When?
Well, the Horrible Histories cast got together, going back to the OGs, and they decided. Yeah.
Major historical breakthroughs in any field, anthropological, historical, archaeological, in the last sort of 10, 15 years, have come from the Horrible Histories group.
I would believe that. Yeah. Honestly, pioneers.
No, like all science, really, it was a build-up of knowledge over time, and then sparking of ideas. So we've known that there are bacteria on the body for years and years, in the last centuries. We've known that bacteria can impact our body. That's where sort of the first vaccines came from. So all of that's been known, but for years there was just no way of actually taking a sample of all of them and then finding out what all of them were. You had to be able to grow them in a lab, and you needed very specific conditions. And most bacteria we can't grow in a lab, well over 90%. Mm-hmm. So we just don't know about them. But we knew that they were there. And then this next generation sequencing came along, where you could have these mixed samples, and you could start to pull the DNA out from lots of different living things all in one go. And that kind of set the stage. And looking at it in modern people began in around sort of 2007. When the Human Microbiome Project started. And so they were looking at the gut microbiome was really the big one, but sampling from all over the body. And of course, people are, academics are at different conferences, and there's academic papers, and there's Twitter, and there's just people chatting. And eventually someone in the ancient DNA field would go, oh, this is kind of interesting. And in their minds, of course, the first thing is, well, can we look at this in ancient people? What would be a way of looking at this in ancient people? And we run into the problems we've already mentioned. Well, most of the bodies tended to be gone at that point. It's just that kind of realization. Oh, dental calculus is these solidified, entombed bacteria that's still on the teeth. Could we give it a go? And so 2013 was when a few people gave it a go.
I feel like science is a lot of people going, we could try it.
Yeah,
give it a go.
Why not?
Pretty much science in a nutshell, really. Yeah.
And all of that conversation happened on Twitter.
All of it.
And
on
then
Twitter.
The next day, it's just like, yeah, go on then. Go on. Let's have a go.
Yeah, maybe not all on Twitter, but it is. That's like, well, can we do it? And as I say, 2013, the first paper that came out that recovered bacteria from ancient dental calculus, they pulled a very specific bacteria out and sort of proved that it was there. And then where I ended up in Australia, the Australian Centre for Ancient DNA, they were the first ones that were like, can we do a full community? And then they were the first to show those shifts of the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution. And that was really it. It was like, yeah, this seems to work. Let's keep trying. Let's keep trying it in different situations. And we found out several things along the way. So the first type of sequence we did that was being done was called amplicon sequencing. And that's where you look for a very specific piece of DNA that you know that all the bacteria have, that is unique, also has like a unique pattern for each species. So they would get that and they'd find out what it was. And then, you know, a few years in, a couple of years after they published that paper, they realized, this doesn't seem to preserve equally from all bacteria. So you end up with these biased samples where some are overrepresented and some are underrepresented. So you're kind of getting a skew. Didn't affect those original results because they were working on such a kind of high level because it was the first time they'd done it. But as you're trying to drill in and get more and more detail, you start to realize this is a problem. So the field switched to something called shotgun sequencing, which is where you just go, any bit of DNA, just tell me what it is. Hence the name, a bit of a shotgun approach to the whole process.
That sounds like my way of dealing with anything.
Which seems to be more representative of what the past actually was. I mean, that's hard to tell. You can't go back and check. Did what I've done now actually, not swab them in the past and go, oh yeah, that lines up. So
be really good if you could, though. Really good.
It would, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Just pop especially back. Just check those results, It's like,
Why is that how you go back in time? Back. You just sort of lean over your shoulder.
Through a little door.
Through a door?
I don't know. Little time-travelling door I've got here. I'm like, that was right. And there is still work being done. So it's not like you've got the dead people, you've taken off plaque and you've sequenced DNA and it's just like, we found these bacteria. And as you said, you've then been able to see certain things like, did they drink milk or not? There's still loads more being done. Not necessarily on the same dead
same
people.
Person. Same just going back again. Sorry, we missed a molar.
Can we have some more of your teeth?
No, we don't go back and resample them. Usually, do a bit more, bit more cleaning for them. But the same people will be used moving forward. So, like I said, there's up to thousands, tens of thousands of bacteria in this, and you do one run of an analysis, and you get your results, and it's all sound and fine, and then someone else does something, and then you realize, actually, we could go back and look at it at a different angle, or now we know that actually how we did that analysis wasn't, there's something we might have missed or we've oversimplified. So all of that data will remain in databases and publicly accessible. So you can study exactly the same groups that I did, or from those databases, you can put the groups that I sequenced with the groups that other people have sequenced and then pull it together into one massive pattern. So I look specifically at Britain through time, but now we're building up this kind of historical picture from around the world. So you can start to see how do different parts of the world did it behave similarly? Are there differences? What's going on? What about when globalization happened? Did people start moving around a lot more? What's that doing to us? What does that mean for modern health as well? You mentioned, we spoke about Yakults, but... the gut microbiome and keeping that in balance and the health and everything that's there. That's all well and good. You can sample as many modern people as you like and say this is a healthy person, this is an unhealthy person. But how representative is that of the community that our bodies actually evolved alongside? And until you get that historical perspective and you can track it back through time, perhaps the modern microbiome's only been around 10 years. Or maybe it's been around for tens of thousands of years. And it's basically it's been around really for the kind of 20th century. That's when it all massively shifted. So this work is anthropologically interesting, learning about people, learning about their history, but it's also medically relevant because perhaps what we want to get people back to keep them as healthy as they can be is actually something that we can find from the past and not from just the healthiest person we have today. And maybe we'll have, rather than bacterial yogurt drinks, will have bacteria and toothpaste to help keep everything in balance. Who knows?
You'd buy that toothpaste.
Yeah, I would.
You love stuff like that. You'd be all over that toothpaste. And then you'd send a message to the rest of the family going, everyone should buy this toothpaste.
Look what we've got. But actually, what we've already learned is none of your pasta or your white bread. Not that we ever have
right.
white bread.
If you're about ever. To tell me that you're going to try and take pasta away from me, I swear to God I will drive back to Bristol and sack off the rest of Series 3 right now.
No, you just have to apologise to your teeth every time you eat.
My teeth love the pasta, it's okay. My teeth are made of pasta.
If you're a good apology each time, we'll sort the whole situation out.
And I think I was just going to go back to one of the things you said earlier about the fact that we only know 10% of bacteria.
Less than 10%.
Right. There's less than 10% of the bacteria.
Is it going to mess with your head?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. There is so much we don't know.
Yeah.
It's like,
crazy.
Are humans really like the super species? No. Bacteria is.
Well, obviously.
Well, I mean, it raises some really interesting ethical questions as well. Like, if you are as much bacteria as you are human in terms of cell counts, and if these things are critical to your body functioning, you know, if you go in to study a modern population, what then become the ethics of that? You know, most people, when they're asked, are not fussed. They don't consider their bacteria to be part of them. Part of their identity, but you know, it's maybe something that you do need to check with people. You know, and as the microbiome and the, you know, its impact on health, it becomes more and more known, and we actually get to a point where we can really start to treat it sort of in the everyday medicine. You know, that perspective might shift, and then how this research is done might have to respond to that.
So much easier to research on dead people because you don't have to worry about the ethics side of things necessarily.
Yeah, no, the dead people do tend to they're not too worried about what you do, but there are ethics there, you know, so there's a kind of weird sort of blank spot between sort of what we've called modern DNA and then the start of ancient DNA, where these people are dead, but they're kind of old enough dead that we don't know who their family are, but their family are still around, and so you can't ask permission, which you would need to do. And then there's a kind of shift into sort of a pure archaeological sample. But again, then there's ethical considerations. The museums have human ethics for working with these collections, both based on, you know, preserving them for prosperity, but also on the cultural importance. And if you're doing this around the world in different cultures, you know, lots of people treat their ancestors in different ways. So it's not absent at all in ancient DNA.
And so what other things have we learned from that bacteria around the world? Are there any other differences in what bacteria has been on these people? Or?
Yeah, I mean, this is a work in progress, understanding this around the world. Yeah, but we are seeing that, you know, different groups around the world, particularly historically, did have different bacteria, certainly in their mouths, which I don't think is a massive surprise that these groups and, you know, the bacteria that they're exposed to in their environment. Because imagine, like, we've all become hyper aware of it, I guess, recently because of COVID, but, you know, putting things in your mouth, sticking your keys in your mouth when you're, you know, trying to get something in your pocket, or, you know, rubbing your face, the foods you eat, how you've washed them, all of this kind of stuff are impacting it. And that's different all over the world. Different foodstuffs, different environments, tropical versus temperate, and so on and so forth. And I think the interesting questions start to come in, as we say, about the globalization and whether when one group has moved in to where another group has traditionally been, you know, how much have they transferred their microbiome between groups, whichever way it's gone, what has that meant for the health of people, that kind of stuff. So
it's an area where, as time goes on and things get researched more, we'll find out even more interesting things.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like I say, 2013 was really the kind of start point for the ancient DNA. Now 2021 seems like a long gap, but we're so early in the jigsaw of putting this all together that it's still considered a very new field.
So in 10 years' time, we'll have you back. You can talk to us again.
Sounds good.
See what interesting developments we'll have. Because who knows? Yeah. I mean, by then we might all be dead.
Well, I'm glad we're staying positive.
Through bacteria.
Never. Not anymore.
But I also loved, I was just, I'm off in my own little science fiction-y thing about the fact that we are just hosts to bacteria. And I'm imagining all these bacteria complaining, oh God, they put that in the host body again. It's like, oh, for God's sake, this one's really crap.
Pasta again.
Treating us badly. Yeah.
Oh dear.
Just like workplace grievances among bacteria.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Bacteria is going, well, yeah, it will just revolt.
You're just writing is. A comedy show.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for telling us about it, Andrew.
It's all right, thank you.
I'm going to be dreaming about scraping teeth, which I'm not sure is a good thing, but I'm interested by it.
I already want to go and brush my teeth.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. And I'm concerned that now I've got to eat dinner and I'm going to be really aware of my teeth.
And aware of quite how much bacteria I have to look after and the responsibility of that, really.
So thank you for the breakdown. Enjoyable.
Yeah, I'll come back in 10 years and see how close to rocking in the corner of the room you are.
Yeah, perfect. We'll book it in.
Excellent. I like that. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to drink non-alcoholic really nice. Gin, yeah. Which is lovely.
Yeah, I'm dead impressed.
Yeah. Well, thank you for introducing me to it.
Lovely.
Lovely.
Right. Dentist for the Dead. Dentist I want to know. Dead. I reckon there probably is a novel out there that was a Dentist for the Dead, but it would be really bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas those Dentists for the Dead are pretty cool, pretty hardcore to do the whole. I don't think I could do it.
I don't.
The
think
whole scrapey scrapey, all no. wrapped up
in your stuff,
your suit, and your three gloves.
Three gloves. That's three a lot. Gloves.
How can you do anything with three gloves? I can't even operate anything with one pair of gloves on. But three gloves and then bashing things with hammers.
But an exciting new area of research, which hopefully we're going to learn lots of stuff from.
Yeah, and already finding out. I mean, I didn't realise that there was quite that much bacteria on our bodies and that we don't know about.
And that you can see the difference between before farming, because I've always thought farming was a really good thing, but no, not for our teeth.
It was really shit.
Yeah.
For our health in general.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You know, when they think everything at the moment is all about how super processed food is really bad for you, but actually that started with farming.
Yeah.
And actually we've just got more and more processed and all of that is bad for us host bodies of all that bacteria.
But non-alcoholic gin... Lovely.
Non-alcoholic gin.
Really good.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And you can learn an awful lot about people from their bacteria.
From the bacteria.
And do you know, what I also got was he was saying about, you know, learning what they're doing from the ancient dead people's teeth can also help with the mapping, you know, with all that bacteria and seeing what goes on with the bacteria.
Yeah.
You know, it will all connect also with the future.
Yeah.
And how important bacteria is, and even looking at medicines and how our microbiomes, and it's just like,
it's just a world. Well, it's bacteria's world and we're living in it.
I quite like bacteria in that way. I'm imagining them, you know, there are some really nice ones.
Okay, it's time for me to go and eat some pasta now.
No, we do need to eat some pasta.
Yeah.
But yeah, really cool. You can learn a lot of stuff about people through their...
And watch out for Andrew's Citizen Science Project.
Yeah, absolutely. If you would like to donate your plaque from your teeth...
Send us an email.
but don't send us the plaque.
No, please don't. See you next week.
Hope you enjoyed that little episode.
You got to the end, so hopefully you did.
That's very true. Well done.
If you'd like more content from us, then you can follow us on Instagram.
You can. And you'll also find our chief gin taster, the Gin Monkey, with tasting notes of all the gins that we're tasting in the series. Go on to Instagram, so it's worth following.
Yeah. Topic Gin.
Topic Gin.
Same on Twitter.
Same on Twitter.
What send us Facebook? A little tweet.
Yeah, we're on Facebook too. Topic Gin, keeping it all nice and simple.
And you can email us.
You can, if you want, at hello@ginandtopic.com. If you click subscribe as well, that would be really handy. Reviews,
whole host
tell
of
people.
Stuff for you to do.
And we'll be back next week
with another episode.
I know.
And another guest.
And another gin.
Yay.
And don't forget to join me and Emma in our new tasting room on Sunday, and she can tell us all about the gin.